Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through the current edition of my Sunday sermon. California has felt fairly apocalyptic this past week. Although things during COVID have felt quite apocalyptic this past week in particular, as these last 2 weeks have felt very apocalyptic. We had a heat wave, which was only interrupted by fires. Especially for us to the west of the valley, there have been many fires. This has been the most active fire season ever in the state of California. And in Sacramento, we didn't have our heat wave because we didn't have that much sun, because the sky was filled with smoke, the sun was red. And just last night in downtown Sacramento, there was a riot. And the National Guard, the sheriff is requesting the National Guard, and on we go. So in the midst of a global pandemic, we're ordered to stay outside to avoid transmitting the virus. And with California burning, we all had to go back inside. And Antifa is in Sacramento. So feeling fairly apocalyptic. We've sort of gone from Golden State to Crispy State. The sky goes dark, the animals die, the rivers are polluted, the sun doesn't shine, people flee their homes only to have to find it difficult to breathe. But now that picture I put up is, oh, by the way, there's a contentious presidential election, which sort of feels like it's pulling the country apart, making this little interesting cartoon of California is hell, Kevin Newsom turning over and saying, speaking of climate change, which apocalypse would you like? Now, we've been talking about liberation as we go through the book of Exodus. The present structures upon which we depend are also part of the structures that impose or oppress. Last week, the Israelites first heard words of liberation, that God was going to free them. And then when Moses and Aaron actually went over to Pharaoh to say, let my people go, Pharaoh said, ha, how do you like this? I'm going to have to demand the same quota of bricks, but I'm not going to be as kind as to provide you with straw. And so, well, so much for your desire to go out for your little prayer meeting in the wilderness. That just shows you don't have enough to do, so canceled. Signed, Pharaoh, God Provider. And the members of the Israelite leadership go to Moses and say, you've caused more harm than good, and we're still in oppression, and what do you have to say now? Now, these cycles go again and again. I pulled up a 2004 study that looked at the results of the race riots from the 60s and 70s, and what those studies in 2004, obviously 15, 16 years before our current unrest, suggests that, well, no matter how justified you feel about expressing your rage in the street, the results usually perpetuate the injustice. In fact, a very close study showed that the riots in the 60s, the physical losses they produced, the memory of certain associations between neighborhoods and physical loss, the desire of insurance companies to raise rates or not insure certain businesses in certain areas, create a psychological association that continues to harm the community far after the rubble is clear. Now, knowing this, I grew up sort of in the aftermath of that in the 70s when, you know, I became a teenager and looking around in many of the places on the East Coast where unrest had been. In fact, a lot of the wealth inequality between African Americans and white Americans actually had its seeds in this, because the values of the homes of African Americans went down. And if you want to read about this, you can read about it in the New York Times. And now we seem to be following along with the cycle again. Now, there's hosts of injustices that go along with this kind of thing. Here in Egypt, we have ostensibly Africans enslaving Israelites, and generations of Israelites that had been enslaved died without ever seeing their personal liberation. In the Americas, we had a similar thing from 1619 to 1865. Generations of descendants of West Africans died without seeing their liberation. What are we supposed to say about this? Well, What God had said at the beginning of the book of Exodus is that he saw the people of Israel, he remembered their covenant, and he knew. Also, last week, he said, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out. I will free you. I will redeem you. Then you will know that I am the Lord. And then he promises to, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. Then I'll multiply my signs and wonders in Egypt, and he will not let you go. And I will lay my hand on Egypt, and with mighty acts of judgment, I will bring out my divisions, my people, the Israelites. And the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring the Israelites out. But the Israelites remain skeptical. We'll believe it when we see it. Well, we're going to follow the story even after they get out of Israel, and we'll see where their believing takes them. Now, the following chapters always present a challenge for a preacher because there are a number of chapters full of these, as we're used to calling them, plagues. They're not consistently called plagues. Sometimes they're called wonders. And the purpose of them very much seems to be a drama in the heart of Pharaoh, which sets up the much disputed question about, well, did God harden Pharaoh's heart? Did Pharaoh harden his own heart? Or did Pharaoh's heart harden itself? There's a great deal of repetition in the plague story, but there's also increasing development in the plague story. And so I'm going to walk through 9 of the 10 plagues in succession, just highlighting the succession of the drama and the conflict as the authors clearly intend to portray it. Pharaoh, Moses and Aaron first walk up to Pharaoh in chapter 7, and they use those signs, those wonders, those miracles that God had given Moses to use. And so the staff becomes a serpent, and the magi, and I'm going to use that word intentionally because these are court magicians. These are the same types of people that go to find Jesus and lay down gold, frankincense, and myrrh. They are court wise men who look to the skies and are intermediaries between Pharaoh and the other gods and are there to support Pharaoh and to counsel Pharaoh and tell Pharaoh what to do. So when the staff of God becomes a serpent, the magi duplicate it, but Aaron's staff then eats theirs. Now, Pharaoh's heart was reported to be strong. Now, what I have on the other side of the slide here, and those of you who are listening obviously can't see it, is a chart which basically shows all of the heart passages in these chapters. And even though your English Bible will show hardening hearts and use the word hard in English, there are actually 3 words that are used to communicate the status of Pharaoh's heart and the cause of its hardness or its strength or its weight. And we'll get into that in a little bit. So the first plague starts, or the first wonder starts, with the third of the signs that God had given to Moses, which is Nile water to blood. Pharaoh's heart itself is made weighty or glorious or heavy, depending on how you want to translate that Hebrew word kavod. But by this you will know that I am the Lord, they say to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh, of course, previously has said, who is the Lord? And, well, the message is, through these wonders and plagues, you're about to find out. Now the Magi duplicate the Nile water to blood trick, and Pharaoh's heart was again strong. And Pharaoh didn't take the sign to heart. As you can see, this whole passage is about Pharaoh's heart. Now, this is actually quite interesting in the light of the Egyptian Book of the Dead, because according to the Egyptian Book of the Dead, upon death, everybody has their heart weighed. And if their heart weighs more than this feather, which has other mythological connotations in the Egyptian Book of the Dead, if your heart weighs more than a feather, well, then this little demon god eats up your heart and you don't have a very good afterlife. And so many ways here, the heaviness of Pharaoh's heart, but now this word kavod can mean heavy, but it can also mean glory. And so we begin to get a sense of the type of symbolic resonance that this message has. So what we'll notice about Pharaoh's heart is only one time do they actually use a word that we usually in English render as hard. 12 times his heart will be strong. And we might imagine strong in opposition in resisting to the mission of God and Moses and Aaron in this situation. And 6 times it will be weighty or heavy. So the next plague, the second plague, is frogs. And again, the Magi duplicate. But there's a little bit of irony to the Magi's duplicating the plague of frogs, because if you're having a plague of frogs, the last thing you want are more frogs. And that's what the Magi seem to duplicate. Now, the pattern is going to begin to set in here, because Pharaoh initially caves, but then he makes his heart weighty again and backtracks and refuses to let them go. The third plague is the plague of gnats. And the Magi, however, are now unable to duplicate this. And so they now declare, this is the finger of God. And what they mean is that, well, this is no Magi-level intermediation. This is something coming from someone above their pay grade. And so they are now unnerved, and they basically are knocked out of the fight at this point, and they cry uncle. But now Pharaoh's heart makes itself strong in response to this. The next wonder is the plague of flies. And this is the first plague, the fourth plague, in which there's a differentiation between the Egyptians and the Israelites. Now, all of the Egyptians are going to suffer all the way through this thing, you know, whether they agree with Pharaoh or not. And a little bit later, we're going to see that dissent grows in the ranks. But now from this point on, the frogs were everywhere and the gnats were everywhere. But now the flies, well, they're really only going to be among the Egyptians and not in the land of Goshen where the Israelites are. So the Israelites will not suffer with the Egyptians in this. Now Pharaoh offers to offers to say, well, you can do sacrifices, but make them in Egypt. And Moses refuses. And then Pharaoh concedes and say, well, ask Israel to pray for me. And this is another pretty major concession, because remember a little while before he said, who is the Lord that I should listen to him? And now he's sort of asking the Israelites to be his priests, to do mediation between him and his new rival that he is now taking seriously. Pharaoh is beginning to get to know the Lord. But again, at the end of this, Pharaoh makes his own heart glorious or weighty and retracts the offer. The next plague is the one of pestilence, and it's called again a weighty pestilence against the livestock. Release my people to serve me, God demands. The hand of the Lord is about to be present with a heavy pestilence. So this one is getting a warning. And again, there's this distinction between the livestock of Israel and the livestock of Egypt. And the plague, in typical biblical hyperbole, all will die and none will be alive, which careful readers often note by chapter 9, we still find that the livestock is threatened by the hail, and so basically this is going to be a pestilence against the livestock, and many will die. Now, Pharaoh verifies at the end of this plague that only Egypt's livestock has been damaged, not Israel's livestock, and Pharaoh's heart was weighty again. And now, if you look on the chart, the subject of the one who is weighing the heart is doing it itself in the plague of livestock. The next plague are the painful sores. Now, you might be noticing a progression here that in many ways the plagues are moving up the food chain. First, it was the Nile, which is sort of the source of life, and then the frogs and the gnats and the flies, and now a pestilence against their livestock. Now, suddenly, it's their material possessions and their animals that are suffering, and now the suffering is about to come to them. Because the sores are not just on the people, but the people and the animals. And so we're moving closer and closer to the people. And now the Magi, and they're on the Magi and the Egyptians, but not the Israelites. And you might notice, again, a similar progression in the book of Job. Now, at this point, the Lord strengthened Pharaoh's heart. And that sounds very, very strange, but Why? What's going on there? Does the Lord do that by sending sores? Is that the way that the Lord is strengthening Pharaoh's heart? Now, there's often when we read this, we sort of imagine this mysterious God sort of hacking into the eternal code and playing with Pharaoh's emotions, where it could very well be that God is working on these plagues, that the result of these plagues is for Pharaoh to double down and to say, well, this is what people do usually in a conflict. They double down and they get stubborn and they're not going to let anyone go. The next plague is hail, and this one is seen as very dramatic. There'll be a release, a plague, a fatal blow, so that you may know that there is none like the Lord. So now God is announcing his supremacy. I will strengthen you to oppose me so that the world may know. That seems to be what God is saying. Warning, get your animals inside. Those animals that obviously survived the pestilence. And don't, if you don't, believe me, you'll suffer. In other words, you're getting a warning, but this is coming. The Lord is in the right and my people in the wrong, Pharaoh now exclaims after the plague. He sinned again, the Bible says. Pharaoh and his officials gloried their hearts or weighted down their hearts to strengthen and then backtrack. So this theme continues of the hardening and the strengthening and the weighing. And it seems each time at the moment of panic, Pharaoh relents, but then he backtracks and he doubles down. The next plague is that of the locusts. And the Lord here now is the actor. And what you'll also notice that with the plague of sores, Moses is to sort of release something up into the air. And then the hail comes down. So not only do we see the progression of the plagues in terms of getting closer and closer to individuals, but increasingly the plagues are not coming from the bottom up, but they're coming from the top down, which will very much give resonance sort of to the geography of symbolism and faith. The Lord is now the actor. You will tell your children about this, God tells the Israelites. Every growing thing, the basis of life, is going to be eaten by these locusts. And now at this point, there's dissent in Pharaoh's ranks. And the people of Egypt are saying, hey, wait a minute, Pharaoh. We appreciate the fact that this is not a democracy, but you're really not doing very well here. The God of Israel is kicking your butt. And so the idea is, well, maybe the men can go out into the desert for their little worship service and their prayer meeting and leave the women and the animals and your possessions behind. And Moses will not agree to that. And in fact, after this plague, Pharaoh, well, he's getting weaker and weaker through the progression of this. Now Pharaoh exclaimed, I have sinned against God and you. Which, those of you who remember my interpretation of the parable of the prodigal son, this is the speech that the prodigal son in the far-off field plans for himself to, in a sense, win his way back into his father's kingdom. But of course, Pharaoh isn't really going to let the Israelites go. His heart is going back and forth. One day feels one, when the pressure's off, then he doubles down once again. And then the ninth plague, the plague of darkness. Now, there's no more pre-plague opportunity with this. Go, leave your property, Pharaoh says. But no, Moses declines. Remember, Israel's going to plunder Egypt. And at this point, negotiations break down. There's outer darkness, and this in biblical imagery, at least in the symbolism of Jesus in the New Testament, this becomes an emblem of hell. Negotiations are done. Pharaoh says, go away from me. If I see your face again, you'll die. And Moses says, that's right, you won't see my face again. Now, Moses is like the face of God to Pharaoh, and in a sense, with the plague of darkness, God says, you're not going to see my face. Pharaoh, you're heading to hell. In biblical symbolism, that's what's going on here. And what you might notice if you see the chart is that whereas earlier Pharaoh sort of has more agency, more control, the more the conflict progresses, the less and less control Pharaoh has over himself. And in a sense, the more he doubles down, well, the less agency he possesses as this conflict intensifies. Now we're going to pause there because the story pauses and we're going to deal with the Passover next week, because we have the nine plagues and then there's an interruption in the text, and that's very important in terms of the structure of the text. So here in California, we've been going from golden state to crispy state. And one might ask themselves, well, in the words of Romans 1, is the wrath of God being revealed from heaven against the godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness? We have hurricanes in the Gulf. We have fires and, well, we're just waiting for more earthquakes and wars and rumors of wars and civil unrest and, leading this cartoonist, California is hell. Are we the victims? Are we the perpetrators? Were all Egyptians complicit in Pharaoh's slavery of the Israelites? Were all Israelites innocent? Or were they complicit in their own slavery? Now, what's interesting about this passage is it's all about Pharaoh's heart. And it's all about the interplay of Pharaoh's agency and his loss of agency the more he doubles down. That's pretty much what Romans 1 says. This is, in fact, a trial of the heart. Pharaoh uses his agency to reinforce his position until he no longer has agency and is simply backed into a corner. Have you ever seen a conflict get this far where pretty soon people say, "We have no other choice," and they burn down the world? The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the wickedness, godlessness, and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. Although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him. But their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of immortal God for images made to look like a mortal human being and birds and animals and reptiles. Therefore, God gave them over in the sinful desires of their heart to sexual impurity for the degrading of their bodies with one another. And they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. Amen. The words of Romans 1. And if you read that, how does that make the story sound different? The nature of conflict is to escalate. The stronger Pharaoh feels, the more he doubles down. Pharaoh gives in out of weakness, but then relents when the heat is off. Then Israel and Egypt will know. This is the purpose of the plagues. This is the purpose of the wonders. And both Egypt and Israel are getting a lesson by the miseries of Egypt, just like Egypt should have gotten a lesson by the miseries of Israel, but didn't hear. Now there's a show of divine force here. This is justice for past wrongs. That's certainly the case. But this kind of raw power and intimidation brings about a begrudging collapse. And we can see this again and again and again in the pattern that Pharaoh first relents, but then hardens and doubles down. And so what you see is the conflict. Well, this is the kind of conflict Pharaoh was welcoming right from the start. It was a conflict that Pharaoh thought he could win right from the start. But guess what? He can't. But is this really a good thing? Can such a show of force really give God what he's looking for? What is God looking for? What should God be looking for? Should God be looking for the mere deliverance of Israel from Egypt? That certainly is what he's looking for, and that's what he's about to do. But as we see a little bit later in the book, will that itself be sufficient to give God what he's looking for, because now Pharaoh and the Lord don't have a very good relationship. Well, in a little while, Israel and the Lord won't have a very good relationship. What's really going on? From noon until 3 p.m, darkness came over all the land. About 3 p.m, Jesus cried in a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And when Jesus had cried again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, rocks split, and tombs were open. Bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life, and they came out of the tombs after Jesus' resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared to many people. When the centurion and those who were with him were guarding Jesus, saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God." What should Pharaoh have done? But what's interesting here is that this raw show of force is now taken against the Son of God. There's deliverance by darkness and plague and wonder, but now the Holy One is the victim of the wrath of God. Well, the fires are increasingly getting under control. We don't know what will become of Antifa in Sacramento city streets. Lord willing, the heat will relent and fall will come, and at some point the rains will return to California, and maybe the grass will grow again, or maybe there'll just be mudslides. We'll have to wait and see. There'll either be not enough water or too much water, and at some point the big one will come to California. We live in a state of uncertainty. And if you don't believe that, well, it's not just the Golden State, right? Is this the wrath of God? Are we Egypt or are we Israel? Do we want liberation? Well, be careful with your answer, because it is more complex than just getting what you feel you want or deserve right now. Now here, where we or others declare that California is hell, can we trust God in the apocalypse? Because the apocalypse always comes. It might come to the state in the form of fires or earthquake or floods or civil unrest. But it always comes. It comes to each of us individually. How will we welcome it? His own blameless son felt abandoned, yet he rose from the grave. How do you walk? How will you walk in the apocalypse, and what will you believe? Do you have an eye on him where, even at this moment, you might wonder, has God abandoned us? Or, in fact, can you seek him even through the grave and trust him even in the darkness?